It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Scandal of the day. Joe Biden had a taco. Scandal of the day. Not from one of those taco trucks that were supposed to be lining every street the former guy claimed was going to happen. No. Actually went to a taco place. First time as president, Joe Biden stepped foot inside of a restaurant. Celebrate Cinco de Mayo, went for a taco enchilada run to tout the almost $29 billion restaurant program to help get restaurants back up and on their feet. Open up the doors a little bit as we're moving towards the reopening, as swing the doors back open. This program to help restaurants, delis, diners, the food service industry, get them back up on their feet. I think it's something that we need to do, something that has to happen. Today he was at a restaurant I can't pronounce, eating tacos that I'm really not a huge fan of. But good for him. It was the day he went there touting that program. Now, what I find interesting, and this is one of those things where, Joe Biden has the right to go out there and say, hey, look what we did. Look at how we're helping you. Look at how the bill that we passed is going to help get people back employed, help people get back to some bit of normal life, help business owners, especially small business owners, reclaim their businesses, all of that. Look what we're doing. Look at the work we're doing. What I find interesting is the number of Republicans who voted against it. I find it interesting that a bunch of them are touting it, saying, hey, make sure you sign up. There's a trough of money. Go get it. Something Republicans completely understand. They understand large troughs of money. Because if you remember, the first stimulus plan, massive trough for the corporate piggies to get their snouts in. And they did, very much so. But you had a bunch of Republicans, the former vice president's brother, Greg Pence. He's out there saying, hey, yeah, go. And unabashedly saying that, this is, go get it. Help is on the way. Now, that's the opposite of what Kevin McCarthy said back in March on the floor when they were debating this, saying help is not on the way. So I don't know which Republican Party we're talking about. They all have the same R behind their name, but some of them are crazy or some of them are crazier. I mean, this is kind of weird. Now, Pence, anti-government guy, thrilled. We're going to give out some money. I'm going to help the restaurant industry. Help is on the way. You can go through a bunch of these. This Lee Stefanik, who evidently they're touting to push Liz Cheney out of the way for, Beth DeVanduine, Jamie Herrera Butler, Glenn Grothman, that guy from Wisconsin, a bunch of them all voted against it. And you go, how can you do that? How can you go, I'm against it, I'm going to vote against it. If it weren't for those Democrats over there, you wouldn't be getting this. But here, look what I'm bringing you. I mean, it's kind of irrational on a certain level. It's extremely ridiculous, but it is who the Republican Party who has always been. Hypocrites through and through. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, because I hear this all the time. Rick, we need to be more bipartisan. We need to compromise more. We need to come together more. I pine for those days when that may have been possible. This, unfortunately, is not one of those days, evidently. Because, look, you've got these people who were dead set against this. They were united against this legislation happening. They were in strong opposition almost universally the Republican Party turned against it. Now, Tim Scott, he wants you to believe that, you know, back when the former guy was there, you know, we got along and we were able to vote on this. No, that's because Democrats were willing to go, yeah, we're going to give you the win. And they would have given Trump a third win. They would have given him whatever he wanted to deal with the pandemic, because it was about people. It was about our communities. It was about doing the job over doing the political. And this is where the Republicans have fallen down time and time again. Joe Biden is willing to compromise. He said it numerous times. He's been known as a guy who's willing to move around. But you now have, and look, I'm hoping this is the moment. Because when I saw Mitch McConnell again, you may remember Moscow Mitch's statement that, you know, they were going to make Barack Obama a one-term president. That was his goal. They were going to gridlock everything up. They were going to obstruct everything possible, and they did. As much as they could, they filibustered every opportunity. They stopped any real possible legislation that was going to make people's lives better. They were going after it. Now, Mitch has come out and said that 100% of his focus, 100% of my focus is on stopping this new administration. Mitch said, I think the best way to look at what this new administration is, he said, the president may have won the nomination, but Bernie Sanders won the argument. Now, you're supposed to think socialism. So if you didn't get that, that's socialism he's talking about. You know, Bernie Sanders, a socialist. Without identifying the fact that the programs that Joe Biden's moving forward on, popular. People want it. People want a $15 an hour minimum wage. People want massive infrastructure spending, because they understand, one, we'll get better infrastructure. Two, we'll get lots of jobs. Seems pretty sane. Seems pretty rational. Seems like something we could do. Seems like something that could be bipartisan. And look, this is one of those things that I said back when Trump took office, the former guy. I said, had he gone to infrastructure first thing out of the bag, had that been the first club, not the we're going to rip healthcare away from poor people. Had he gone to infrastructure, he would have had a much different presidency. Because that's the area where people go, or at least used to, go, yes, we can agree on roads and bridges and broadband and all of the things that need to be rebuilt. So I'm thinking about this statement by Mitch McConnell saying that, number one, 100%, 100% of his focus, stopping this administration. Which means he wants nothing to get done. He's happy with the status quo. He's happy with the economy being still a little struggling. No investment to get that kick started. So if you're struggling, if you're having a hard time, you're on your own. And oh, by the way, you know, the $28.6 billion in money that's going to go to help boost small business and the restaurant industry, if it were Mitch McConnell's choice, that would not happen, because 100% focused on stopping this administration. Because, again, he wants you to believe that it's all socialism, it's all bad. Yet it's stuff that they had proposed in the past. So I'm looking at this, and good on Joe Biden for just dismissing it. He said that during the Obama years. We'll figure it out. We're going to get by it. But I'm hoping this is that moment. Because we've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, we've got to do this in a bipartisan way. And it's interesting how when Democrats are in power, we talk a lot about bipartisanship. Oh, we need to appease the conservatives. We need to appease the Republicans. We need to make sure that they're taken care of. Make sure that they get input. They always do this. Always. It's like they've got a secret thought. And I think about Dick Cheney, who was asked, you know, if the Democrats would come along with whatever it was they were doing. And he said, look, they'll cave. It's what they do. That's their mindset. And they don't know how to act with, you know, with the way Biden's going. He said, look, we can compromise. But ultimately, I think Biden knows he's going to have to push this as far as he can with the Democrats that he has. And I'm hoping this is that moment where those handful of Democrats who have been a pain in the neck to this point realize that nothing's going to get done with them wishing and hoping for bipartisanship. There is no measure of compromise that Mitch McConnell will make. There are no concessions that Mitch McConnell is willing to take. There's none of this. He has just told you he is 100% invested in making sure nothing happens. It seems like deja vu all over again. Seems just like deja vu. And because we've seen this movie, haven't we? And we remember all the ticking bombs, the debt ceilings, the Screwquester. You remember all those, you know, Friday night at midnight, the world economy is going to go kaboom because America is going to default on its debt because we aren't going to pay the bills that we already made. They're arguing about just paying the bills. It's crazy. And it got me thinking, you know, who are the Republicans today? Do Republicans see Mitch McConnell? Do they see these hypocrites saying, oh, no, here's a ton of money. Here's a trough. Thank us for not getting this for you. That's basically what they're saying. You can thank us for not voting for something that you're going to benefit from. We didn't want you to have it. We didn't think you could use it. But, hey, you know, it looks good on a card. You know, what does this Republican Party stand for? And the interesting thing is if you're looking at this Liz Cheney, Kevin McCarthy situation, where you're just kind of going, exactly what is it that they're doing? They're going to oust Liz Cheney, whom I don't like. You know, the fact that I'm looking at this moment and there is a Cheney that I agree with, that a Cheney is the savior of our democracy, scares me. But here we're in this moment where Liz Cheney's saying, look, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to buy into the big lie. The election wasn't stolen. Donald Trump didn't win. He is not president. Joe Biden is the president. He is not illegitimate. He's the guy. And for that, for the fact that she won't lie, they're talking about ousting her and putting someone in who will. Now, look, I've always looked at the GOP as a bunch of liars, cheats, and thieves anyway. So is it surprising to me that now the liars, cheats, and thieves are actually outwardly saying, yes, we're liars, cheats, and thieves? No, it doesn't surprise me. This is what Donald Trump's main accomplishment was. He let the party be who they are. He let them be racist and misogynist and liars, cheats, and thieves. So now the party's going, hey, we can't let the cat out of the bag that much. So there's part of them going, no, we've got to have this veneer of decency. And the other part is like, no, screw it, we are who we are. And this is where the interesting part of all this is coming from, because Liz Cheney actually believes that, you know, they're the party of the rule of law. They're the party of the law. Yeah, they're the party of limited government, except when it means, you know, going after people in their bedrooms and people they don't agree with. They're party of strong defense. And I don't know anyone who isn't in favor of strong defense. And I've always pushed back on that because it's ridiculous. But anyway, also, she said they believe in prosperity and opportunity. And I'm going, again, who doesn't? What she is calling for, though. And this is the important part. She's calling for a bipartisan commission of non-elected people. People who aren't going to be running for anything. To actually have subpoena power to investigate everything that happened on January 6th. Because at the end of the day, we cannot forget January 6th. We cannot forget the guy who was behind pushing this narrative, who whipped the crowd up and pointed them like a loaded gun in the direction of those legislators. And we've got to get to the bottom of all of this. And the fact that Liz Cheney's coming out and saying, look, we've got to have this bipartisan commission, much like they did with the 9/11 commission. You got to have people who aren't elected, who aren't grandstanding, who are going to do the work and dig. Because, and I agree with her, History is watching us. Our children are watching us. The rest of the world is watching us. Are we going to allow that kind of violence to happen? And this is an interesting moment for me because, look, I look at the Republican Party, which is why I'm not a member, as the party of the elites. I look at them as the party of the extremely wealthy, the business titans, the captains of industry, not the average everyday working stiff who they've bamboozled into thinking that they care about them. But this is a moment where, do they believe in democracy? Do they, the Constitution that they claim to carry around in their pocket? You remember during the Tea Party years, everyone had a pocket Constitution. None of them read it, but they carried it with them. They thought maybe the ink would bleed into them somehow and they would be able to, you know, by osmosis, be able to absorb what was in it. This is one of those moments. Who are the Republican Party members? Which side are they on? And I don't know which side wins. Is it the Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney side? Or is it the McCarthy and the Boberts and the Gates and the other crazy one, Green? Is it that? Is that sideshow, that freak show, the future of the Republican Party? Part of me hopes so. Part of me hopes so, so that maybe we can get rid of them and they can start anew. And that those working people who have been bamboozled into believing that, yes, the boss really does care about them, can begin to reevaluate. That the veneer of they care about us is wiped away. Perfect example. The party of the new working class, evidently, the Republicans, the Republican governor of Montana, Greg Gianforte, evidently is now going to say, he's now saying Montana is not taking any more unemployment benefits from the federal government. So no additional $300 for those working people who are out of work. You're going to go forced back to those crappy jobs. As Ryan was saying, if you have a true labor shortage, if you're arguing we have a labor shortage, nobody will take these crummy jobs, you increase the pay. They don't seem to do that. They just want to force people back into crummy jobs and unsafe jobs. Going to be interesting to see how it plays out. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the new report out by the AFL-CIO, death on the job, how many people died in 2019, and, well, what we've done or what we're doing to protect workers. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More American than workers standing up.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That was the day Wisconsin State Militia shot down workers striking for the eight-hour day in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, killing seven. It's known as the Bayview Massacre. As cities across America erupted into strikes for the eight-hour day, municipal workers in Milwaukee had already won shorter working hours. Many private employers had followed suit. The Central Labor Union and the Knights of Labor mobilized thousands in the campaign to bring the rest of the city's employers into line. Building tradesmen joined Polish, German, and Native American laborers in strikes and marches across the city for nearly a week. They marched to area factories, calling out to workers to join the strike. By May 3rd, every factory in town was shut down except for the Milwaukee Iron Company Rolling Mill in Bayview. Workers marched to the mills and demanded workers join them. At this point, Governor Rusk called out the militia. They formed a line just inside the gate to prevent strikers from reaching mill workers. As the events of Haymarket unfolded in Chicago that evening, area businessmen became increasingly fearful of upheaval brewing in the city. Governor Rusk gave the shoot-to-kill order should any striker attempt to enter the mills. The next morning, as 1,500 strikers marched toward the mill, they were fired upon by militia. Seven were killed, many more injured. Strikes for the eight-hour day ended abruptly. Many union leaders were indicted, and Polish workers were practically blacklisted from working in the city for their radicalism. Though the massacres shattered hopes for the eight-hour day, Milwaukeeans responded by electing populists and socialists in local and regional elections for years to come.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, great story in Virginia today. Well, evidently, the folks with the Northern Virginia Labor Federation, the local arm of the AFL-CIO, decided they were going to take some cake. Who doesn't love cake? This, I guess, is the third cake that they've taken to Senator Mark Warner to get him to sign on to the PRO Act. I guess they've tried chocolate. I guess they've tried vanilla. I guess next might be an ice cream cake. They're throwing that idea around. Anything to get him to sign on and become a co-sponsor of the PRO Act. And as I said earlier today, this is one of those moments. So Democrats, if you're listening, this is one of those issues where there isn't a pass. This is, if you're a Democrat, you sign on to the PRO Act to protect workers' rights to organize and to protect themselves on the job and fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. There is no pass here. There is no, oh, well, maybe next time, because I don't think there is a next time. It's just that simple. So take the cake, Mark Warner. Enjoy the cake and sign on. Anyway, some good news. I guess not good news. A new report out by the AFL-CIO. Actually, some really bad news. They looked at the 2019 death rates at work and the number of people who lost their lives at work. They do this every year. It's their death on the job report. And here to share some thoughts on what they found, I've asked MK Fletcher to come talk with us. She's a safety and health specialist there at the AFL-CIO. MK, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I really get to appreciate sharing these unfortunate findings.
So cake, pro cake?
I don't think that we should send cake for what happened in 2020.
No, but Mark Warner better sign on. And the cake was just a sweetener. It's not a bribe, so stop that. Anyway, let's get to the report. I guess not 2019, before the pandemic. I don't want to see what 2020 is going to look like, but before the pandemic, I guess the report found that 5,333 people lost their lives on the job. That means they woke up, they got dressed, they drove to the job, they were at work, and they didn't come home. That seems like a higher number than the year before. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. It is a higher number than the year before. And 2019 is the most recent data that we have. So it really shows where the state of things in the nation was before the pandemic happened, which we know has been the worst occupational safety and health crisis of our lifetimes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to see 2020, to be honest with you. But I think when it comes, it's going to highlight what we've been talking about for the last year and a half, and that protections on the job are way too weak. And the former guy did a lot of things to break the system, even worse than it was already broken.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this is the 30th year of our report. We really started this report 30 years ago because nobody was tracking what was going on, of what was killing people on the job, how people were getting injured. We weren't tracking the resources and what the agencies were doing around job safety to prevent all these terrible deaths from happening. And we weren't identifying the progress that we made and then the progress that needs to be made. So now we have 30 years worth of all of this information, and we've really gotten to see, you know, the progress that has been made in those 30 years, because, you know, not as many workers are dying on the job, but the number that you said, the 5,333 workers who died in 2019, that number hasn't changed that much. It increased in 2019, but it's always hovered around 5,000 workers for a good number of years. And we really need to see more progress being made and not get complacent, allowing many workers to die.
I have listeners who say, well, you know, it's only 5,333 people. It's not like it used to be back, you know, 100 years ago where you had 100,000 people dying on the job. And you go, well, safety regulations, unions had a big part in stopping the number of people dying because we did fight for better conditions. But we also don't do the kind of jobs that we used to do back then in the same manner. I mean, we don't have 100,000 people working at one steel mill in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania anymore. So, you know, these are our jobs that, are around. Have we looked at who, what kind of jobs are the most dangerous? You know, who's going to work and not coming home? And maybe any ideas on how we stop those numbers from increasing?
Yeah, definitely. You know, every single year we look at the industries and occupations of people who are dying at work. It's usually occupations that you would think, agriculture, fishing, working, but we also look at the different demographics of workers. This year, one thing we really saw was a sharp increase in the Latino worker fatality rate. It really jumped this year. It was a 14% increase.
Wow.
And then also the number of Black workers who died on the job also took a sharp increase this year. It's the highest number in more than two decades, actually, of the number of Black workers who died on the job.
That's incredible. Now, from what I read in the report, something like 66% of the Latino workers were immigrants. You know, how many of them were documented? How many were undocumented? And do we can we be certain that that's an accurate number, given the fact that there are a number of undocumented workers here, that you know, because we don't know how many or where, that you know those things get brushed under the rug. Do you think that's an accurate number?
You know, when you're talking about fatality numbers, there is unfortunately a body to be counted. So I feel like that's probably some closer to accurate. But when you're talking about workplace injuries, right, which can be very severe and very monumental in someone's life and really change the course of their life, we don't know the true toll of those, and we don't know what's happening. It's underreported, period, for all workers, and much less when you have additional things that would make a employer not report those injuries, make a worker not want to share those injuries either.
Right. Now, you know, I look at this, and the reason I ask that is because the shocking thing in your report is you're saying every day, on average, 275 workers in this country die because of hazardous conditions. Now, 5,333 is the number of people who go to work today and don't come home today. You're saying, this report's saying that, you know, 95,000 people die every year because of occupational diseases, exposure to asbestos, exposure, you know, black lung disease, you know, chemical exposures, things like that. What else are we talking about when you're throwing occupational diseases in there?
That is exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about a lot of chemicals that, over time, being exposed to them, you end up with the really terrible diseases, the cancers, the chronic lung disorders, that really have such a long lasting impact on your quality of life at your, you know, the later years when you're supposed to be able to enjoy them. You know, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, one thing when the agency first started that it did such a great job at is it put out standards for things like lead and asbestos and some of these very toxic chemicals. It doesn't mean they're still not an issue in the workplace. They definitely are. But that really made a big impact there. And then now you see there hasn't been as many of those standards for chemicals to come out. The last big standards, health standards that came out under OSHA were under Obama. He just did two of them, silica and beryllium. And I think they're making a huge impact, particularly in the construction industry with silica. But we need more of that. And it took way too long. OSHA had to work on those standards for a really, really long time to get them out the door. So we need to have more of that.
No, it's interesting you bring those up because, you know, it was reported early in the former guy's administration that those were things that he was trying to scale back. Were they successful in scaling some of that, the beryllium and the silica and some of those standards? I thought they scaled some of that back because that was going to be my next question. You know, how much of this could have been prevented? Because we had an administration, the last one, who was hell-bent on deregulating everything because, you know, MK, those job-killing regulations, you know, never mind the people-killing lack of regulation. But, you know, am I wrong in this?
No, you are correct. The last administration did. They were very against regulations and really tried to do that. The union movement really fought against that administration doing anything against taking away worker protections, especially the safety and health protections they'd fought for so long. And unfortunately, the silica standard still stands in place as is and still there to be enforced strongly. The beryllium standard, there were some changes to it. They really tried to completely roll back a lot of it for construction and shipyard workers. Unfortunately, a few things were changed, but the majority of the standard still holds.
Good. Now, the other part of this is, it's great to have standards. It's great to have regulations. If you don't have inspectors, and I understand under the last guy's watch, we are at what could be, well, the lowest point of OSHA inspectors in the history, in the 50-year history of OSHA. I guess at one point we were somewhere like 1,200 inspectors during the Reagan era. It was down to 774 during the last guy's term.
Exactly. We are at near the lowest. Last year in 2019 was the lowest number of inspectors for the entire history of the agency. And for 2020, they did hire a few more people, but it was a very small number of people. And I think it was also because of a lot of pressure that they were getting.
Yeah, you got a global pandemic going on.
There's a global pandemic, and you don't have people to enforce the rules, any type of rules. So it's so key. We really need that investment in the agency so that it can do its job.
Now, one of the things that's of interest to me is today, Marty Walsh, the Secretary of the Department of Labor, who I'm thrilled with, came out and said they're going to make it harder to for employers to declare people independent contractors. How much of when you did this report, were you looking at people who are self-employed, these independent contractors, these gig workers? Do they get added into this, or do we have? Is there no one tracking what happens to gig workers on the job? Because I gotta imagine the Uber and Lyft drivers and some of the package delivery guys who are on their own. I gotta imagine that bad things happen to them. But they're self-employed. They're not employees. They're not workers. Any thought?
Yeah, definitely. The rule made it easier. The rule that was rescinded made it easier for employers to misclassify them as independent contractors. And this is so important in the sp safety space of whether you're considered an employee or an independent contractor, because OSHA can only cover people who are employees. So if you're an independent contractor, you don't have OSHA coverage. So when your employer misclassifies you, they're basically passing the buck, saying they don't want to be in charge of their safety. They don't want to offer you the worker protections that you deserve. And we do track and have been tracking at least the number of self-employed workers and the rate of the fatality rate for self-employed workers. And it is significantly higher than those who are considered wage and salary workers. This most recent data for 2019, self-employed workers were more than four times more likely to die on the job than somebody who was considered wage and hour.
Wow. No, I mean, I was expecting to, well, we don't really know, but you're actually tracking this.
Yes, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does offer that information. They don't have much detailed information on it for 2019. But at least we do know the top line that it is a significant problem.
Because I'm of this mindset, and I know a lot of people who they've been bamboozled into believing they're their own boss. And I come out of the trucking industry, so for years, this is for decades now, thanks to Ronald Reagan. You've got everybody, any Tom, Dick, or Harry who owns a truck is now a trucking company. They're their own boss. Yet, they're told where to go, what time to be there, what to pick up, how to get there. They're told what half the time what uniforms to wear, what can be written on the truck, what can be written on the. But they're their own boss. They don't have a boss. All what they do is they have all the responsibility, all the risk, and they're the ones who are, get the short end of this stick, but they're their own boss. And, you know, I look at this and I'm going, you know, most of the people I know who are in this position don't want to be. They just need a job. They need to make income. And you have an entire industry outside of the unionized industry that's pushing this. So for me, seeing this administration pushing back on this misclassification is really important.
I completely agree with you. It's recognizing that this is a problem, that having these fissured employment relationships are not good for society. And it's also not good for the safety and well-being of workers. And we cannot let employers skirt their responsibilities to keep the workplace safe.
I'm right there with you. Now, what are you hoping comes out of this report? I know you guys have been doing this for 30 years. And I hope folks will take a look at it at AFL-CIO.org. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at the report and see the numbers, these horrible numbers. What are you hoping comes out of this?
Now, it's a lot of things. It's a very long, comprehensive report. But one thing, you know, is OSHA and MSHA, they were created in the 70s. And this pandemic has really highlighted that they are so critical and important. And these agencies really need to be bolstered with the resources they need to hold employers accountable when they're not doing their jobs and keeping workplaces safe. And also, you know, we know people need strong, comprehensive protections from COVID-19 right now. That still needs to be done. It's not over. Working age people have taken the brunt of it, and we're tired of that. With workplaces reopening, those who've been at work and those who are being asked to go back really need those protections in place.
Yeah, at the end of the day, MK, for me, it's you know, union job equals safer life. You got a better chance of going home, and I think your report does lay that out. Non-union workplaces are less safe than union workplaces, and as you've pointed out, the gig jobs much less safe.
Definitely, and we need that accountability there, and we need the government to hold those employers accountable.
Right there, and it comes back down to policy. We need the PRO Act. We need to end this gig nonsense, and we need to go back to the bargaining table. But MK, I appreciate you taking some time. Thanks so much for sharing the report with us.
Thank you so much.
MK Fletcher, safety and health specialist there at the AFL-CIO. Make sure you check out the report, the death on the job report. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that became known as the Battle of Harlan, or the Battle for Everts. Harlan County, Kentucky was coal country. Miners worked long hours underground and faced dangerous and often deadly working conditions. If they attempted to form a union, they risked not only losing their jobs, but also getting evicted from their company housing. Despite this response, starting in the 1920s, the United Mine Workers of America began to make headway in organizing miners. In Harlan, the miners who dared organize were fired. They and their families were thrown out of their homes. The company brought in hired guns to enforce the evictions and to keep the union out of the mines. Union miners and these gun thugs met on the road outside of the town of Everts. A gun battle broke out. Three company men and one miner were killed. The governor of Kentucky once admitted, quote, "There exists a virtual reign of terror in Harlan County, financed in general by a group of coal mine operators in collusion with certain public officials. The victims of this reign of terror are the coal miners and their families." The Harlan County Mine Wars raged on for the next decade. In all, 13 miners would give their lives trying to bring a union to the Kentucky coal fields. It was one of the bloodiest struggles of the U.S. labor movement. Bloody Harlan earned its nickname.
They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You hear it be a union man without a change.
Which side are you on, my?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, some good news out of New York. Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the HEROES Act. I guess just happened. Thanks to you, our listeners who chimed in. Thanks to all the working people of New York to push that through. It's going to be interesting to see how the rollout of this happens, and if other states come along as well. But look, at the end of the day, for me, it's about how we make sure that that 5,333 people who died in 2019 on the job, that number goes down. And look, you know, the gig thing is one of those. I remember when I first learned about, you know, the independent contractor. We didn't call them independent contractors when I was a kid. We were subcontractors. We had a different name. Same thing. You're on your own. You're your own boss. My story was simple. I was 18 years old. I needed a job for the summer. A friend of a friend said, hey, you know, this guy, he builds houses. You know, they pay pretty well. You'll learn how to build a house. I'm like, hey, yeah, I love being outside. You know, we did a lot of drinking. It was a good summer. And, you know, near the end of it, I'm at work. And it's weird now that I look back at how stupid I was. But, you know, you're 18. You don't really know anything. Every Friday, the boss would come and he'd hand out envelopes with cash in it. And it never dawned on me. I filled out an application. I did the whole nine yards. Never dawned on me that I wasn't an actual employee. Nobody ever, you know, ever said any of that stuff. There were no taxes taken out. There was none of that stuff there. So, you know, one day, I'm on my hands and knees and I'm hammering at something. And a guy with the nail gun shoots and misses the stud and puts it right into my foot. Right in the bottom, right through my shoe. And, you know, I'm hopping around, you know, not happy. My shoe's full of blood. And I go, I got to go get this looked at the doctor, get a tetanus shot or something. And the foreman's like, well, that's on you. And I'm like, no, I'm going to the doctor. He goes, yeah, but you're going to have to pay for it. And I'm going, that doesn't sound right. That's when he explained, you don't actually work here. You just do work here. You don't actually work for the people building these, you know, several hundred thousand dollar homes. You're on your own. And this is when I really started to become mentally a labor activist, because it shot me in the foot. And, you know, I went to the doctor. I went to my family doctor and, you know, I got a tetanus shot and all that stuff. And that was the last day I worked building residential houses. The last day I did any construction work. I'm like, the heck with this. But it got me, you know, it got me in this mindset that, you know, there are protections to being an employee. Workers' comp being one of them, that if you're injured on the job, that you'll be taken care of, that your medical bills will be paid, and you don't have to figure out how to do it on your own. Because look, I look back and I go, boy, was I stupid. What would have happened? You know, I'm up, you know, three floors off the ground with no walls, no safety harnesses, nothing, you know, hammering over the edge, you know, climbing up ladders with, you know, 80 pound, you know, things of shingles. What happened if I'd have fallen? What happened if something, and who knows what? You're SOL, because you're your own boss. You take on all the risks. And it got me, you know, this is why I've kind of become the labor activist that I've become. So when I learned about the Lochner era, this idea that, you know, if you're desperate enough and hungry enough to work in poverty conditions for deplorable wages, that's your liberty. It's your freedom. It's what you can do. I'm not going to have some government get between you and a bad deal. Not going to have some government tell you that you can't enter into an agreement that's going to make you work 60, 70, 80 hours a week at below minimum wage. That's your right. And here's the thing. You know, when I was 18, I didn't know what my rights were. And the reality is most workers don't. So when they take these jobs, oh, you're a gig worker now. You're your own boss. They still think there's some protections there. There's not. And we're going to relive a lot of those horrible Lochner era type things. For those who don't know, the Lochner era was 1905. New York passes the Bake Shop Act that says that bakers can't force their workers to work more than 60 hours a week. It's bad for people. It's certainly bad for the product because you got somebody who's never getting any rest or showering or any of that stuff. And in these really hot, horrible conditions, they tried to limit the number of hours that people could work. Not like we do. We'll just pay you overtime. No, just 60 hours. You can't work above that. So they fined Joseph Lochner twice for violating the, because he was like, the heck with you. You know, I'm going to work my guys as long as they'll work. He ends up taking it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rules liberty of contract. That if those workers want to work 100 hours a week, that's their liberty. It's their freedom. Not. They didn't bother to take into consideration that these workers were desperate and the wages were so pathetically low that they had to work 100 hours to make ends meet. No, they didn't consider that. All they considered is that you have the freedom to make a bad deal. And there's part of me that goes, you know, I understand that on a certain level. But when you have corporate power and you have an uneven situation like we have in the war between capital and labor, when the wealthy are saying, well, you know, we just won't pay you and you'll starve, or your kids will starve, or you'll be homeless. It's kind of an uneven situation. And I look here in Pennsylvania where I live, and I say this all the time, our workers' compensation law still refers to the employer and the employee as master and servant. But not in the liberty of contract realm, because you have the right to quit, which is why workers' compensation was brought into place, because all the workers were being blamed. What? You got hurt? That's your fault. You shouldn't have done that. Now, granted, someone dropped a pile of bricks on your head. You shouldn't have been there. It's your fault. So I look at this and I'm going, you know, we're just circling back to the same bad ideas. So during the last guy's administration, when he made it easier for employers to label workers as independent contractors, allowing the pendulum to swing further to the side of employers, I was against it. And what you have are people who go, oh, no, I've kind of figured out how to make, you know, a little bit of money doing this. I'm getting by. I'm just happy to have something. And what I'm saying is you have a system right now where employers are doing what they're doing on the misclassification front because it benefits them. The only reason that we have this is it's cheaper for them. And it's a lot cheaper because they don't have to pay unemployment. They don't have to pay workers' comp. They don't have to pay state and local taxes. They don't have to pay any of this stuff. Unemployment, nothing. You're useful when you're useful, and then you're on your own. Now, there are some who say, well, you know, I like being my own boss. And that's okay. You can do that. Nobody's saying you can't. It's just saying that the employers can't force people into that situation. And again, I go back to the trucking industry where I'm from. I think about these guys who were pushed into these lease agreements. There was a trucking company a number of years ago, I think MS Carriers. They had this lease program where you could, you know, lease the truck and it would be yours after a certain amount of time. But you basically worked for poverty wages during the lease agreement. And they would just, from what I remember of the guy who I basically just broke his heart by explaining to him that after 7 years, his truck was going to basically be close to worthless and need a lot of work done on it. Because you're going to have over 1 million miles. You're going to have to, you know, redo just about everything. He thought he was going to be his own boss. Working for half the wage and buying someone else's truck. Home 5 days in a year without a penny in his pocket. But he was okay when he was thinking, I'm doing this for myself because I'm my own boss. Because he had been sold this idea. But what it really came down to is he just needed a job. He needed to be able to support his kids. He needed to be able to support his family. Understand, the business class isn't going to do something that's beneficial to the working people at all. Now, maybe you found something, and I know a couple of Uber drivers I've met who they are able to make an existence out of it because it's a good tax cheat. They're able to write off the mileage. They're able to write off all of their expenses, and they're able to do a whole big write-off thing, something that corporate America has been getting away with for years. So the little guys figured this out. Uh-oh, hey, you know, we can deduct a whole bunch of taxes, and we won't have any showable income. This is how corporate America is lining their pockets. And it's angering and frustrating. And I'll be honest, I'm happy to see the Biden administration moving in a direction that is more sane and more rational. Now, you know, you see a lot of these on-demand things, you know, the DoorDashes of the world. And I had someone send me this tweet about DoorDash, where this person, Scott Frazier, says, just stopped from ordering deliveries unless I understand and agree that DoorDash employees are not employees and acknowledge and agree that DoorDash is not a delivery system, is not a delivery service. So the person who's, understand this, now this is what this guy's saying, he stopped ordering because you have to click in boxes saying that you understand that the person bringing you your food is not an employee of DoorDash, and that DoorDash isn't responsible for the delivery. They're just the app. They're just the conduit. They're just the middleman who takes the money. They have no responsibility to anything or anyone. They're just taking your money. And I was looking at the contract that says you understand and agree that DoorDash provides technology, a technology platform connecting you with an independent food service provider and others that provide the products offered through these services and independent third-party contractors who provide delivery services. Contractors. They go on to say, you acknowledge and agree that DoorDash does not itself prepare food or other delivery services and has no responsibility or liability for the acts or omissions of any merchant or any contractor. Merchants is the retailer. The service offered by DoorDash pursuant to this agreement do not include any retail services or any food preparation services. DoorDash is not in the delivery business, nor is it a common carrier. DoorDash provides a technology. You have to agree that someone just shows up to your house. You don't know who they are. They're just providing you an app. Well, what's that Fight Club thing? You don't talk about Fight Club. It doesn't exist. I guess this is where we're at. And it's this kind of stuff that's insane to me. The stuff that we're willing to give up just to make a living. And then the stories we tell ourselves. You know, I think about some of the Uber drivers I've met who you ask them, you know, why do you do this? You know, because you expect, hey, you know, I need a job. You get every excuse under the sun. Well, I have extra time. Well, you know, I got bored sitting at home. Well, you know, I really like people. Never once has someone go to me, man, I'm desperate. I need the money. I'm broke. There are no jobs out there. And the jobs that are out there are crummy. And I guess that speaks a lot about us. I mean, I love the American optimism that even in crummy situations, we try to find the best. But this is one of those things that just, it comes back down to policy. And, you know, I was reading an article by one of these right-wing groups. They were saying, you know, Joe Biden is fighting the battles of the 1930s. Work has evolved. You know, people want to be exploited and used. People want to be have their entire life revolve around the work that they have to do just to be able to support their kids. I don't agree. I think most people want to have a decent job. They want to have decent health security, decent retirement security. I think most people just want to be able to work, spend time with their family, and lead a decent life. Now, there are some people who then want to go beyond. They want to run their own business, and they want to do other things. But I think the mass of people, they're okay in a situation where you go, hey, you know what? I like the job I do. I'm good at the job I do. I take pride in the job I do. But I don't want to work 100 hours a week. I don't want to be responsible for all of this breaking down or that breaking down. But what we're doing, and this is part of the Trump tax code. For the first time, we encouraged independent contractors, small businesses, people, doing their own thing over employment. And we changed the tax code in ways that allowed them to be able to take advantage of that. And I don't necessarily know that that's a good thing. Because all of the institutions that we have, like Social Security and Medicare and unemployment and workers' comp and all those things, are dependent on people being actual employees and paying into it. And what happens when you have a number of people who end up being injured, who end up being harmed? They end up falling on the back of Social Security. Again, another cheat. So I'm against it. Glad to see Marty Walsh and the Biden administration moving in the right direction. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1852. It was the last day of a three-day convention held in Cincinnati, Ohio. Printers who worked for newspapers and other publications from 14 cities had converged to decide if they wanted to form a union. The printers had first met on the question of starting a union 2 years before in New York City. Now they were ready, and with a vote, the National Typographical Union was born. The very first action of the new union was to denounce Sunday workdays. Only one person cast his vote against the motion. The printers would play a leadership role in the U.S. labor movement. Printers were located in major cities across the U.S. Even more importantly, the union's members often worked for newspapers and had a skill set that could help get the word out about union news and actions. 17 years later, the organization changed its name to the International Typographical Union in recognition of new Canadian locals that joined. That same year, the union decided to let women into its ranks. This made it one of the earliest unions to do so. In 1870, Augusta Lewis was elected as corresponding secretary. She became the first female officer of a nationwide union. The ITU was known to be a very democratic union with strong locals. As printing technology changed, the union faced many challenges. Computers dramatically transformed the work of printing. These technology changes reduced the numbers and strength of the union. In 1986, the ITU merged with the Communication Workers of America. One of the ITU's most famous members was author Mark Twain, who joined the Typographical Union as a young man and proudly held his union card for the rest of his life.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.